From WWNO, this is Music Inside Out. I'm Gwen Tompkins. This and every week, we talk to people in Louisiana who've devoted their lives to music. We want to hear about their experiences and listen to what they're listening to, because that's where our music comes from. This week, piano savant John Cleary talks about the alchemy of groove making.
You have to have a good sound, you have to have a good audience. You have to be in a good mood that day. There's all millions of variables, any one of which can prevent it from happening. But every once in a while, when it does happen, it's huge.
Can you dig it? John Cleary takes us home after the break. Stay with us.
One, two, one, two, one, two.
Got it?
This is Music Inside Out. I'm Gwen Tompkins. Have you ever taken a good, long, and lasting look at John Cleary?
My, my, oh, oh, I love you so.
He often wears a wide-brimmed hat and the remnants of what used to be a really nice suit. Linen, maybe, or a tropical lightweight wool. Cleary looks like a shabby chic aristocrat of the tropics, an out-of-luck gambler, maybe, or a sugar planter whose cane won't cut. But Cleary's sugar is all in his hands. He's mastered piano, guitar, mandolin, dobro, bass, and the B3 organ. He's a great sideman, having played with George Porter, Bonnie Raitt, Taj Mahal, Junior Wells, Ryan Adams, John Scofield, and Dr. John. But don't be fooled, Cleary belongs out front.
I feel so damn good, I'll be glad when I get the blues. I feel so damn good, I'll be glad when I get the blues. I'm so down being up, y'all be stuck with it when I start to lose. When I'm good, just ain't good enough. I got to have a little rough with the smooth. And if life's too easy when I'm standing still, well, it's time to get up and move. I feel so damn good, I'll be glad when I get the blues. I'm so down, been up, I've been winning when I start to lose.
Okay, I liked you, and now I love you.
You took bum notes and all.
That's wonderful.
I don't usually play boogie-woogies this early in the morning.
John Cleary has graciously invited us to his house in New Orleans. Sorry to insult your clothes.
No, that's a pretty accurate description, yeah. Used to drive my mum nuts when I was a kid. She'd go out and buy me a new pair of shoes, and I'd spend half an hour scuffing them up in the garage. I can't bear anything new.
Is that right?
Yeah, I don't like new stuff. No, I'm sort of comfortable until it's worn in. And
you always look comfortable. Yeah. I have to say, have you ever worn a tuxedo?
Probably under duress.
It must help your, you know.
If it's
it
a gig that requires
hands.
Me to wear a tuxedo, I just don't take the gig.
Okay, that's for other piano players.
Yeah.
Oh, boy. Well, I tell you, now, you're an Englishman, of course, but when you play, you sound like a black man from the Ninth Ward here in New Orleans. And I say that because I'm from the Ninth Ward. So I can say that, all right? How do you, you know what I mean, how do you make that happen?
Well, I guess you play music the way you hear music. And I grew up in a family of musicians and music lovers.
And the music I had reference to, the stuff that turned them on and turned me on too, was black American music of different eras and from different regions. And so my mum loved New Orleans jazz. My dad had been in a skiffle band. I grew up hearing him playing Lead Belly songs and stuff at home. It was the first things I learned. My Uncle John lived in New Orleans and came back from New Orleans with suitcases full of 45. So I got hips of Snooks Eaglin and Clifton Chenier and Professor Longhair when I was about 10 or 11 years old in England at a time when you couldn't get those records outside of New Orleans, probably. You'd
exactly.
have a hard time finding those records in Los Angeles or New York. And here I was in a village in the countryside in England with access to all these great New Orleans R&B records. And it would be impossible for me to sing a song with an English accent, an R&B
really?
Song. It would be so weird. But I speak with an English accent, but my default mode of playing music and singing is New Orleans. You know, if you're a session musician, you have to be able to play all sorts of different styles.
Right.
But if I just sit down and play, my natural musical accent, if you like, is New Orleans.
It's Night New Orleans. Ward
or whatever part of New Orleans, you know, uptown, downtown, back of town, any part of town.
It's true. What yeah. ward is this?
Ninth Ward.
That's
baby.
What I thought. Yeah. All right. Yeah, we're neighbors.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, but you were born in Kent. Is that right? Kent, England?
I was born in London, actually. My family are all Londoners. And they moved down to Kent when I was a little kid. My dad, my mum and dad were the generation that were evacuated in the war years when the bombs were dropping in the Blitz.
Yeah.
And he remembers vividly, he's told me many times, being in the countryside and seeing a cow for the first time. Growing up in the projects in North London, you'd never seen pictures of cows, but never actually seen a real cow. So we grew up in the beautiful Kentish countryside. They call it the Garden of England.
Yeah,
so
the Garden of England.
Sleepy medieval villages and rolling pastoral countryside, apple orchards, hop farms.
But
a world removed from New Orleans. My mum just would melt every time, you know, if Teddy Buckner's version of West End Blues would come on, she'd just stop whatever she was doing, close her eyes and just start swooning. And that, well, you know, my family were really moved by music, and when you observe this stuff when you're a little kid. My musical taste came really from within my family.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in England in the 70s, growing up when I did, we had two music programs that came on.
Okay.
On the television. We only had three television channels. And at 7:20 on a Thursday, you could watch Top of the Pops, which would be the charts, chart hits. And that was the 70s. It was the era of glam rock, and I hated the Bay City Rollers and Gary Glitter and Sweet and all these daft bands. But there was another program that would come on called the Old Grey Whistle Test, which was, you know, more adult, sophisticated rock. And that would be guys doing 10-minute noodly guitar solos, and I didn't really like that either. And I was a guitar player. I started playing guitar when I was a kid. My dad showed me all his, you know, they'd have sessions down at the pub, and they'd all come back home afterwards, and there'd be music in the front room, everybody playing. And so that's how I learned to play.
Were there any songs in particular that you remember and you remember very well as songs that kind of helped nudge you into the direction of either playing guitar or of taking up music professionally?
Well, there was at school we had one record player and about five records. It was a little parochial village school called Collier's Green. I think there were about 30 students in the whole school.
Wow.
And they had a tiny little record, little box record player. And one of the records was Can't Buy Me Love. This would have been about 1967, I'm guessing, or 68, 69, sometimes. So the record was already like 5 or 6 years old. But the guitar solo kind of rang a bell. And I was only a kid. I would have been about 7 or 8 years old.
The Beatles. Yeah!
And then when I was about 14, punk rock happened, and that was really exciting. Sex Pistols and the Damned and the Clash. And me and my mates would bunk off school and get on the bus to Hastings and go and see the Stranglers.
We came across the West Sea. We didn't have much idea of the kind of climate waiting. We used our hands for guidance, like the children of a preacher, like a dry tree seeking water, or a daughter, nice and sneezy, does it every time.
Every punk gig they would have a reggae band. All of a sudden, there's this explosion in great reggae music. So we got to see these hip bands that were coming over from Jamaica. And that's still one of my big passions. When I'm relaxing, I listen to Caribbean reggae music.
That's lovely. And so your friends, did they have the same aspirations that you had? I mean, to become musicians or?
No, there was no musicians around. I was the only one, really.
But it must have been kind of odd to them, the idea that you guys are hanging out, you're watching, you know, reggae, you're listening to punk, and you are playing, you know, sort of New Orleans music. Or...
I know. When I get home, I'd be listening to Professor Long and trying to figure out, you know. Big Chief, you know, all this stuff. So there were two different compartments to my music. The punk thing was dreadful, but they actually played with a lot of energy.
Yes.
And that I really picked up on. And then when I came to New Orleans, when you see 70-year-old men getting down in a street parade playing, they got all the energy, all the soul, and they could play too. It's like, thank you.
It's true.
That's what I was looking for.
Yeah.
I wasn't getting in England.
Punk plus musicality.
Just the attitude where you dig in and you play hard. You know, you work, you bust a sweat.
Ready? Here it is.
getting crazy up in here. Up in here. More with John Cleary in a minute. Stay with us. This is Music Inside Out. I'm Gwen Tompkins. John Cleary is with us. But for a long time, he was with Bonnie Raitt. He wrote some of her funkiest songs in recent years, Fool's Game, Unnecessarily Mercenary, and together they recorded I'm in Love Again All by Myself, a 2007 tribute to Fats Domino. But none of that would have happened had Cleary stayed a guitar player.
Well, you know, Dr. John, he started off as a guitar player, and then he was shot, you know, in the hand, and then presto changeo, he a piano player was born, you know.
Sure.
And so, what was the aha moment for you? You know what I mean? When you decided, you know, maybe the piano is my future.
Well, we had a piano in my house when my grandmother, whose stage name was Sweet Dolly Daydream, when she was a young girl, she lost her arm in an accident. With the compensation money, she bought a grand piano. She spent one arm, she spent all the money on a piano.
Wow.
And that piano is still now, and she gave it to my mum and dad, and that's the piano I grew up playing with as a kid. We'd like use it, we'd drape tents, drape sheets over it and pretend it was a camp, or we'd climb on top of it or hide things in it. It was just a great thing to play with, and occasionally you start banging on all the notes, and then I started figuring stuff out, and so I really started messing with the piano quite young, but I didn't really take it seriously until I came to New Orleans.
Yeah, about when was that?
That was about 1981,
mm-hmm.
something like that, and I didn't bring a guitar with me, and the house that I moved into had an upright piano.
Terrific.
And so all of a sudden here I'm in New Orleans, I'm hearing piano music. One of the best piano players ever came out of New Orleans, played in my local bar every Tuesday night, and would hang out at the bar all day. I see him all the time, James Booker.
Oh, boy.
And so when I get home, I'd sit down and just try and figure out, you know, I'd spend all my money on records, on Huey Smith records.
Sure.
And would get off of work and go home and just sit there and play the piano and figure it out.
That's pretty great. What was your job back then?
I was a banana tree digger-upper.
Of course you were.
First of all. I wasn't bad at that, but that's hard work, man.
That
digging
is
up banana
hard work.
Trees is really hard work. So I graduated from that to laying a brick patio behind the maple leaf, which is still there, and it's so gnarly and wobbly. It's a sort of sorry testament to my inadequacy as a bricklayer. And then despite that, the owner of the bar very graciously offered us the job of painting the bar. And the deal was we could get to see all the bands for free.
Mm-hmm.
We got half-price beer at night. And we got free beer while we worked. Free whatever we wanted to drink, only in New Orleans. And we could work whatever, however many hours we wanted a day.
Oh, boy.
And so a job that should have taken 6 weeks took us 6 months. This is me and my mate from school who'd just come over. So a 6 months painting, getting covered in paint, doing the worst painting job. But I think because at that time the bar was very popular with people in the construction industry, they realised that despite the fact we were such lousy painters, we were actually paying for ourselves, because all the construction guys would come and to watch, to see what a bad job we're doing and fall about laughing. They'd all get their beers and come out and watch us. Like we're rolling about on the floor laughing as we were dropping paint cans on the sidewalk and accidentally painting our heads green as we were trying to balance a gallon of paint and a Dixie beer at the same time.
Wow, it's like
so
reality
it
TV.
Oh man, when you were 17 or 18 years old, it was great.
But and now you can actually say, you know, I built the maple leaf, or at least I kind of built the maple leaf.
Well, I splattered it with a shade of green paint. I think it'd probably be more accurate. But we had a ball, and it was great, and I got to see all this amazing music.
In those early days when you were listening to James Booker, did you ever figure out what the heck he was doing? I mean, a lot of people have dedicated a lot of time to figuring out what James Booker was doing on that piano that made it sound so good.
A lot of people dedicate a lot of time just to trying to figure out what James Booker was doing, piano or no piano. What on earth was that guy doing? He was a character. He was given scant respect, really.
Yeah.
Now he's dead and gone, and in the grand pantheon of New Orleans piano players, he's assumed his proper role as one of the true greats. Back in the day, Tuesday night, you'd be lucky to get 10, 15, 20 people in there sometimes.
So you started off as a sideman. How did that, you know, how did you grow your reputation as a sideman?
Well, I think if I, to a degree, I think I, whatever reputation I might enjoy, I sort of enjoy it by default, really. I'd always been on a bit of a quest. But when I started playing piano, I started playing New Orleans piano. But at the time I came here, there weren't many people that really had much interest in that stuff. Amazing to say. I mean, and so I think I kind of got hired by default because there wasn't anybody else that could do it. So I got hired by Earl King. And
wow.
And when it came to Lonely, Lonely Nights, I knew how the piano solo went, and he looked, he nearly fell over. And how on earth do you know that?
How does
he
it
wasn't
go?
Wasn't used to younger cats. Well, it just like, you know. Boy, I've been so long, I can't remember. That kind of Toots Washington, Huey Smith
kind of
style. Anyway, so I got to play with Earl King, and then it went on. I got to play with guys like Tommy Ridgely and Ernie Cato and Jesse Hill.
Oh, the good guys.
All the guys that invented New Orleans R&B, really.
On your first album, which was Alligator Lips and Dirty Rice, which is a great title. You do a lot of covers. Not, the whole album is in covers, but a significant number of songs are covers. And like including Big Chief, which is so fabulous. Do you feel like as an artist coming into this area that you have to show people what you know of the classics before you can, you know, introduce your own music?
No, I don't think so. I don't think so. I mean, that recording session came about at short notice. And I had to come up with some songs that I knew everybody could play and songs that I was comfortable with. And we'd actually just played the weekend before in Houston. A club owner in Houston had asked me to put a big band together for a special anniversary or whatever. So I hired my dream band at the time, which was, you know, George Porter and Punchy Johnson and a bunch of horns and stuff. And John Brovin in England made it possible for us to go in and to do the same thing in the studio. So we basically did our gig.
Right,
you said. That whole record was recorded and mixed in 24 hours. So, you know, warts and all, that's what you got.
Like a bookie from the Seabiscuit era, you know what I mean? Like, you know what I mean? From the 30s or something. I mean, the words that you choose, particularly the words that show up in your songs and your lyrics, you know what I mean? They're old-fashioned, great old-fashioned words. Coochie coo, cha-cha as an adjective and a noun.
I like juicy words. I like juicy words.
You really do.
English language is a great toy to play with.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You know, like, pin your spin. Where'd you get that?
I don't know where that came from, really. I mean, that's all that song was about, spin doctors at the time, but it was kind of a relevant thing. So pin your spin. Yeah, I mean, I write down stuff I hear.
Yeah.
We just cut an album, and there's one song with a line, I wouldn't do that, me.
Exactly.
And that's real New Orleans, it's kind of thing. Old. Only if people would say, no, I wouldn't do that, me. And that's, I wouldn't do that, me. Boom, boom. That's the hook of the song. That's all the cats would do. Well, that was the expression everyone was coming out with all day long. I wouldn't do that, me.
I wouldn't do that,
so
me.
So anytime I hear, my ears are wide. I learned that from Earl King.
Yeah.
Earl King used to write stuff down and keep a notebook, and he'd hear something, and I saw him doing it. And that's, I kind of learned that from Earl.
Exactly.
So now it's easier now because you have your iPhone. You can just type it in, you know.
Do you have any heat songs on your new record? Because I've noticed that you have a lot of heat songs that go through your career.
Of the Flames and
Burn. Burnt Mouth Boogie, Too Damn Hot, Moonburn.
Well, you know, some like it hot. New Orleans is hot. Everything is hot down in New Orleans.
It's true. I wondered about that. And then I noticed that, like, where you come from, or in Kent, the temperature rarely gets over 75. And I thought, oh, Lord, what is this guy doing down here?
Yeah. That was part of, believe me, that was a large part of the appeal of coming to New Orleans. Man, it's hot. It's hot. You're the first one that pointed that out to me. So,
let me ask you this. Would you be willing to play as much or as little of Burnt Mouth Boogie?
Sure, I'll play some of it if you like. Yeah.
Really? I love that song.
It's really only one little... Every time I play it, it's different. Every time I play all my songs, they come out different. There's like one or two little key elements, but I'll play it to you.
It is hot.
All right. Let me, if I can play it without messing it up.
Now that's hot.
It's just a little gimmicky. It's not very, it sounds, it's one of those little things that kind of sounds like, whoa, it's very easy to play. It's not very difficult at all.
It does not look easy to play, Mr. Cleary.
Where do you learn as a musician? You can go up the top at the dusty end and play lots of fast stuff. You know, it's like birds are amused by bright, shiny objects.
Yeah, that's true.
The same thing kind of goes for generally non-musical members. Musicians always go, oh, God, bloody show off.
They're just jealous.
But every once in a while, you have to kind of do something which sounds dazzling, even if it really isn't.
This is Music Inside Out. I'm Gwen Tompkins. We're at John Cleary's house next to his smoking hot piano. Tell us about the Monster Gents. These are the absolute monster gentlemen who helped you, you know, so early in your, you know, in your recording career, and who, you know, played with you for so long, on and off.
The absolute monster gents are Big D on guitar, Jeffrey Jellybean Alexander on drums, and Cornell Williams on bass. And they're longtime friends of mine. Cornell and Big D used to be in a band called the Friendly Travelers, gospel group. They were that was my favorite band in New Orleans. And then one year, you know, whereas previously I'd always used the old session guys in New Orleans, one year I got called to put a band together for Jazz Festival. And I'd been writing a lot of songs, and people would always say to me, why don't you do any of your own songs? I'd say, well, because I don't have a budget to rehearse, and it's hard to get the old curmudgeonly jazz musicians to put the extra effort in. They just want to come make the gig, have some have good fun, and go home, you know. So I thought, well, let me do it differently this year. So I'm going to call a couple of the cats from the Friendly Travelers, my friends, and see if they want to just do it. But, you know, we'll do it right and rehearse and work on some original songs and do something different. So I called them and they said, boy, what's taking you so long? We've been waiting for this call for ages.
Aww.
Which was really nice to hear. I said, of course we can. So we got together and started working on material. And we said, well, can we get to play drums? And they both immediately said, well, you've got to get Jelly Bean. And I wasn't familiar with Jelly Bean, but we all went down to Bourbon Street to hear Jelly Bean. And we all sat in and it was great. So Bean joined the band. And it fast became one of, I think, without wanting to sound like I'm boasting, I think it was one of the best little bands in town. Enjoy something of a cult following outside of town. You know, cult followings are usually small followings by definition. And it's the perennial challenge to go out and make enough money on the road to make it work.
If you got a good thing, my friend, hold on tight. Don't do like somebody I know, let it slip on out of sight. Try hard, try some more, 'cause a thing worth having, something worth fighting for. Tried your best,
ain't it hard?
You failed the test.
Oh,
baby, best ain't good enough. Whoa, whoa, yeah. Well, now I try to be forgiving, and we all mess up sometimes. You take kindness for weakness. You really think my love is blind? Yeah, but you just pulled your last and your shoulder stroke. And now it's really over, and I don't want you no more. Tried your best,
ain't it hard?
You failed the test,
ain't it hard?
Oh, best ain't good enough. I've been trying for such a long, long time. This good thing going on. Oh, if you don't try, then you just don't get. Believe me, I've been trying for so long. Best thing good enough. Well. Come on. Yeah.
Funny enough, one of the places that really, really embraced us early was Australia.
Wow.
And we have and sell lots of records in Australia, and we still have lots of fans out there.
On your 2002 album, which is self-titled, John Cleary,
yes.
You know, you write the most beautiful ode to your band members. I wonder if you might be able to read a little from it.
Ooh, this is going to be embarrassing.
Well, you're not going to cry or anything, are you?
Try and hold back the tears. Probably more embarrassing, but the fact my eyesight is so bad.
Well, these are just reading glasses.
Oh, there you go. Thank you. Yeah. When all the elements are in accord and the monster gents are digging a trench a mile wide in the early hours of a Sunday morning at the Maple Leaf Bar, when the mercury in thermometers is shattering glass and you can slice the humidity out in the streets with a wave of your hand, when the spirit's in your soul and the groove takes control, and when you close your eyes and feel like you've been lifted 6 feet off the floor, That's the moment when there's not a man alive that can possibly feel greater satisfaction. Cornell, Big D and Jelly Bean, as well as being among my best friends, absolute monster musicians in their respective fields, soulful scholars and gentlemen, are bloody good fun to be around and a pleasure to share the stage with. To have the funkiest band in a city that's renowned for having the funkiest bands in the world is a rare privilege. Thank you, fellas. Yeah, I'd stand by that. I wrote that a few years back, but I'd stand by that. Yeah.
That is stunningly gorgeous.
Oh, thank you very much. Well, it's easy to write stuff like if you mean it.
But I like that phrase so much, digging a trench a mile wide in the early hours of Sunday morning. That, tell me about that image. I mean, when you're playing on stage and digging that trench, as you put it, I mean, what is that like? I know what it's like to be in the audience, but I don't know anything about what it's like being on stage.
Well, musicians always talk about the groove. A trench a mile wide, that's a hell of a groove.
Exactly.
You know, and you can play a song much as in the same way as you can recite a poem or you can have a conversation. But there are certain moments, as I think I alluded to it there, where it just seems like all the elements are in accord. It's inspiration. It's about being inspired. And inspiration, by definition, is something that's elusive and rare and delicate and hard to attain or achieve or capture or trap, whatever the correct verb would be. But there have to be all sorts of other things. You have to have a good sound. You have to have a good audience. You have to be in a good mood that day. There's all millions of variables, any one of which can prevent it from happening. But every once in a while, when it does happen, it's huge.
I ain't putting nobody down. Don't wanna rock nobody roll. How you found gonna be funky people if you can't cook it with soul? Why we got no hipper than what you got? Watch your back, get the hell out the way. Let the gentlemen do their thing.
That's John Cleary with the absolute monster gentleman, live in Australia with Mo Hippa. Coming up, Mo Cleary. You saw that coming. Stay with us. This is Music Inside Out. I'm Gwen Tompkins, and we're with multi-instrumentalist John Cleary at his house in New Orleans. Everybody in New Orleans claims to be funky, but John Cleary backs it up.
Okay, so I think at this point it'd be a good point to play some piano and just give a little lesson
in
funk.
I think that'd be great. What is funk, but, John Cleary?
Yeah, funny you should ask me that. Well, I'll try and explain in its very basic and simplest term for anyone who might be listening who is curious about what this means too. And of course, down here in New Orleans, you don't have to explain it to people because they're down here, people get it, but everywhere ain't like New Orleans. So for people outside of New Orleans who might be listening, funk, at least as far as I understand it, and I don't claim to be an expert on this, but it's the way you break down four beats of a bar and place an emphasis on odd accents, which in themselves are a little bit upsetting and require a restorative balancing act. So it's all about introducing either dissonance or syncopation and then restoring the equilibrium. And that's kind of a metaphor for what we all of us deal with in our daily lives, and that's why it kind of resonates, I think. That's my personal opinion. But to show you, giving you a simple example, if you've got four beats of a bar. 1, 2, 3, 4. Now, if I want to play some funk against that, some accents against that, maybe. Okay. So then if you take away the four beats and you're just left with... And now you put a funky bass line, which also is comprised of accents. So. Mm-hmm. that's one example. You can do a million different varieties. I'm just making stuff up.
Mm-hmm.
But that's basically what you're doing. You're playing straight beats and then odd accents.
May I ask you a question?
Sure.
Okay, can you take a song that we all know and show us the difference, like between a straight version of a piece of it and a funky version
all
of
right.
a piece of it?
I don't know what made me think of this song, but this is a song that's decidedly not funky.
Okay.
Maybe, yesterday, home, the trouble seems so far away. Da 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 da. So, yesterday. I mean, yesterday sounds great without any funk. To play funk, that would be a horrible crime against a beautiful song. Enormously tasteless to try and turn that into a funk tune. It just serves as a vehicle to explain. I probably could have picked a better example. That was the first thing that came into my head.
No, that's very good.
But it
good.
Illustrates
that's very
the point.
Good. Yeah.
There are some songs that are straight and some songs that are funky.
So there's something in funk that where you have a beat that's implied, meaning that you don't have to play it. You can play the other parts.
Sure.
And people will infer
sure.
that from those
sure.
other parts. Well, what did the meters think about your version of Just Kiss My Baby? That thing is an event. That's not a song. That's an event on your record.
Yeah, I was quite proud of the way that came out. And interesting, the stuff, you know, the bulk of the song is just the vamp at the end, which we played unaware that it was being recorded. We assumed that the machines had been turned off and we just carried on playing. It was a point at which normally you would have faded a tune. But we were having so much fun, we just kept going. But that one tune gives you an idea of what we do on the gig, because that was kind of inspired and it was improvised.
Yeah.
We made it up as we went along.
It had movements.
It goes all over the place. It ducks and dives and takes turns. And I knew we'd done something good when I got a phone call one day from Art Neville. He just heard it on the radio for the first time. I had to pull over.
No.
And called him up and said, who is that? And got my phone number. He said, man. He basically said, thank you. And so that was validation for me. If RT dug and Zigaboo heard, Zigaboo told me he loved it.
Zigaboo Mowgli's.
And then I saw Leo a while back and he said he had just heard it and really dug it too. So that's lovely.
Yeah, Leo Nielsen-Talley is telling you that he really dug it, then he really
yeah.
dug it.
Yeah.
I love yeah. that.
No, it's very nice. There's nothing nicer for me than getting a sincere compliment from someone who I really admire. That's true for all of us, isn't it?
record of Alan Toussaint's music, a cappella. I thought to myself, oh, these are two gentlemen meeting. It's like, you're like, remember that those old Greg Poupon mustard commercials? You know, these two guys roll up in their Rolls Royces and one
yeah.
says,
oh,
excuse me, but do you happen to have a Greg Poupon? And the other one says, but of course. That's you and Alan Toussaint talking about your record.
Well, I've always loved Alan Toussaint's songs and, you know, by virtue of being a piano player here in New Orleans, our paths have crossed. I don't know Alan very well, but he's always been very nice to me.
But you brought on a lot of talent for that record. You know, I mean, on one song, is it Let's Get Low Down? I hear Dr. John. I hear Bonnie Raitt. I also hear, who else? Is it James Singleton
James
on bass?
James Singleton on bass, yeah.
That's
great
an amazing
bass player.
Lineup.
And Terrence Higgins. I brought in a few people, you know, that I needed for particular things. But it's kind of like a homemade record. I did it here, right here in my little studio. And necessity is the mother of invention.
Yes.
I had no record deal.
Are you serious?
And so I felt it was time to make a record, but no record deal, not one that was attractive. And so if you don't have any money, but you have a studio, it's time to buy a drum set and learn to play the drums, get the bass out and get shedding on the bass. And so I played all the parts. So it was an interesting
experiment. Oh, my goodness, experiment. I didn't realize that.
Yeah, I did the whole thing. And then I'd bring the gents in for... because they sing parts I can't reach. And I brought Walter Washington in just because I love Walter Washington so much. I just wanted to show off and have his name on the record of mine. Because he was my teacher in a way when I first started playing in his band years ago.
Yeah.
And then Mac Rebenek. Yeah. I thought, wouldn't it be great to have him come in and play guitar on a tune? Because when I used to play with him back in the day, we would switch and I would play piano and he would play guitar.
Okay.
Which was always a thrill for me. And we did a little bit of that on this last tour, this summertime. So he came and played guitar. And Bonnie very kindly sang a part on the record too. And that was it.
Let's get low down.
Let's get low down.
Tucson is, you get a whole package with Alan, what he does. He, I think, is a songwriter who in his head hears the finished thing.
Do you?
I do, yeah. And that's why I think he probably does, because I kind of understand that.
You know, I was going to ask you, would you play a song that's upcoming that perhaps you would like to share?
Let me think for a second. Well, I'll play you a little bit of a song I haven't recorded yet, which I might do for this next record.
Does the record have a working title?
I'm thinking of calling it Go-Go Juice. It's a shy, romantic, self-searching piece called Go-Go Juice.
Say you want it your way. Say you want it all. Yeah, but you can't have it both ways. Cause that's no good to me at all. I'm not your part-time lover. To use and throw away. I need my love like any other. That's all I'm trying to say. Ooh, baby, want it all.
So on, it goes like that. So it's a love song. Wow. And interestingly, half written by me, half written by my mum.
Is that right?
Because I was back at home struggling with this song one time, playing in the other room.
Can you keep going just for a little bit?
I don't want to give it all away because you have to buy the record. You have to buy the record when it comes out. Right. It's called All or Not at All. But I was struggling with a lyric and my mum had been doing the washing up. And she'd obviously been hearing me struggling over and over again. And she just came in with this covered in soap suds with this soapy piece of paper and go, would that work? And it was,
wow.
Boy, it was just the perfect lyric for the song, you know. I'm not just here the odd days you decide to call. You gotta love me always, or you don't love me at all. I mean, just nailed it. So yeah, so it was written by me and my mum.
And so will she be receiving the royalties on this one?
Yes, she will. Yes, she will. Yeah. We can buy each other a bottle of champagne if it actually ever comes out.
I'm sure it will. So thank you very much.
Yeah, you're very welcome.
Gosh, you've been good.
Yeah, I'm glad you enjoyed. I like nothing more than talking about music and any chance to brag about New Orleans and what we have down here. Yeah, I take that.
John Cleary spoke with us from his home studio in the Ninth Ward. And you've been listening to Music Inside Out. Our show is produced by Lynette Johnson, Sean Collins, and Jason Rhine. Our theme song was composed and performed by James Booker. I'm Gwen Tompkins, and this is Music Inside Out.
Music Inside Out is underwritten by the Historic New Orleans Collection, the New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Foundation, and WWNO. For more information on how you can support our program, go to our website at musicinsideout.org/support.